Greetings. You're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society is an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars devoted to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, ciceroniansociety.org. My name is Ethan Alexander Davy. I'm a professor of political science at Campbell University and a member of the board of directors of the Ciceronian Society. We will begin with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Glory to thee, our God. Glory to thee, O heavenly King, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, Lord everywhere present, and fillest all things, treasury of blessings and giver of life. Come and abide in us, and cleanse us from every impurity, and save our souls, O good one. Amen. Today we have the third installment in a series which I have decided to call Forgotten Conservative Thinkers. The first two podcasts in this series were episode 50 on Konstantin Leontiev, the Russian Orthodox Nietzsche, and episode 71 on Lev Tikhomirov, the Russian Orthodox monarchist. I didn't know that I was going to do a series at that point, so those episodes are being retroactively shoehorned into it. I also thought about calling the series Aristocratic Voices, because we published a book with that title. It doesn't matter so much what we call it. If you're listening to this, tell me in the comments which title you prefer for the series, and we may take your opinion into account. In any case, our subject today is the Scottish man of letters, Thomas Carlyle, who fits very neatly under either heading, as will the other figures I have in mind. Joining me today to talk about Thomas Carlyle is my old friend Scott Irving. So a few words about Scott. He was born and raised in Dumfries, Scotland, which is quite close to where Thomas Carlyle himself was born and raised. Part of the reason I've invited Scott on is that I wanted an authentic Scottish voice to be part of this conversation, and I'll say more about that in a moment. Scott read modern history at Oxford University, and he's written one of the essays for my edited volume, Aristocratic Voices, Forgotten Arguments About Virtue, Authority, and Inequality. Scott's essay is about Giambattista Vico, and I'm hoping to bring him back later in the series to talk about Vico. Vico is another of the unjustly forgotten aristocratic conservative voices of the past. Scott, welcome to The Sower.
Nice to be here.
So there are a few more preliminaries we need to get through here. There's one thing I want to cover right at the beginning, and this is the specific edition of Carlyle's works that Scott and I are discussing. Most of Carlyle's writings were out of print for many years, decades even, but starting, I think, in 1993, a group of English professors got together with the University of California Press to produce the Norman and Charlotte Strauss edition of Carlyle's major works. And I have several of them here on my desk, and I'll just do a show and tell here. So we have Sartorus Sartus there. And probably his most famous work on heroes and hero worship, the lectures that he later adapted into a book. Past and Present. A collection of Carlyle's historical essays, and that is, as you see, these are huge volumes. They're about to knock my desk over. And then the one that we're going to be talking about today, Essays on Politics and Society. Now, I want to recommend these editions of Carlyle's works, not just because the publisher sent me a free review copy of the last one. They are genuinely superior to the competition. And the main reasons for this are that the editor's critical introductions and the notes. So the introduction to each edition does more than place the text in historical context. It also cites many of the contemporary responses to Carlyle's writings. But even more important, from my point of view, are the notes. The notes fill up about as much space as Carlyle's text in each of these volumes. And this is important for two reasons. First, Carlyle loves to make allusions. We'll see examples of this in this podcast. Allusions to contemporary persons and events, to history, to literature, both ancient, medieval, and contemporary, to the Bible and other religious texts. And some of these allusions are obscure. The notes explain all the allusions. And also, since the editors of these editions are Carlyle scholars, they have read everything that he ever wrote, including Carlyle's letters, so they often print excerpts from his letters that are relevant to the topics that come up in the texts, or relevant excerpts from other works by Carlyle in the notes. So if you want to understand Carlyle, these are the editions to read. Okay, now that I've praised the Norman and Charlotte Strauss edition of Carlyle's works, I'm going to make an appeal to the editors. There's one major book of Carlyle that needs a new critical edition, and this is his Latter-day Pamphlets. I have an old copy of it on the shelf that was published in the early 20th centuries, 1910 or something like that, and that's the last time that it was published, I believe. So, but if you go on YouTube today, the Latter-day Pamphlets seems to be his most popular book. It was apparently offensive even to 19th century liberals and progressives. But to be honest, if you've read Carlyle's other writings, there's really nothing terribly surprising in what he says in the Latter-day Pamphlets. And we'll show you some of this today. So I'm not sure why there has been this shyness about the Latter-day Pamphlets in the academic community. And in any case, it's a book that people are reading, so there's a definite need for a Strauss critical edition of it, published by the University of California Press. So there, I've made my appeal. All right, so that's that preliminary done. The other preliminary is to say something about Carlyle's life and the reception of the reception of his writings in more recent times. And once we've done that, the format of this conversation will be as follows. So we've selected several passages from Carlyle's Essays on Politics and Society, and Scott is going to recite the passages for us, and then we'll discuss them. Now, the reason I want Scott to recite the passages is this. Thomas Carlyle once had an audience with Queen Victoria, and she wrote down in her journal her impression of him. She described Carlyle, Queen Victoria did, quote, as a strange-looking, eccentric old Scotchman who holds forth in a drawling, melancholy voice with a broad Scotch accent upon Scotland and upon the utter degeneration of everything, end quote. So not very complimentary, but when I read this description, it actually made me like Carlyle even more. Anyway, my friend Scott is not strange looking, nor is his voice melancholy, but he does have a Scotch accent, and he and I have often discussed both Scotland and the utter degeneration of everything. So this will lend some authenticity to this whole business. All right, so let's talk a little about who Thomas Carlyle was and how we encountered him. So I'd like to start with Scott's impressions. You grew up, Scott, near Carlyle's old stomping grounds. And I'll mention to our listeners that when I visited Scott in Dumfries several years ago, we made a pilgrimage to the farm where Carlyle lived with his wife, Jane, after they got married, called Craigenputtock. So when you were growing up in Dumfries, was Carlyle part of the local lore? I know that there's a Robert Burns Society there, but what did people know about Carlyle? What did people say about him? Was anything taught about Carlyle in the schools?
As far as school goes, let me begin with the last point. As far as school goes, it was goose egg, zilch. There's no, it was as if he had never been. You could find him in the school library by accident if he hadn't already been cleared out, right? The local lore's a bit more interesting. People would know of him, but again, he was no longer read. Which is a very, which is a very interesting happenstance when you consider his stature globally in Anglophone literature, and the fact that we can rightly claim him as you know, our own. I first encountered Carlyle, in art. There was a bust of Carlyle in the local library. I went to the library since I was very small, 1 or 2 years old, and I remember at the top of the staircase, before it would go either way at the landing, seeing the bust staring down as I walk in. It was a very imposing impression, and it seems kind of appropriate. Once you read Carlyle and once you appreciate his stature in English letters, and the sway that he held over English literature throughout the world for most of his life and most of that century.
Right, that's right. That's interesting because okay, so he people knew who he was, and you had busts of Carlyle in the library, but still nobody read him, and nobody knew much about him. So that's right. The personality is known, but what did he say? Right, and so when I was growing up, no one had heard of Carlyle at all in you know in Narragansett, Rhode Island, where I'm from. When I was in high school, I was doing a research paper on Herman Melville for an English class, and in some secondary source, I can't remember what it was, Carlyle was suggested as one of the influences on Melville, and the author included a long quotation, which I read, and I remember thinking, I've never seen anyone who writes like that. So the next time I went to my local used bookstores, I grabbed whatever I could. And I believe at the time that not, almost none of Carlyle's works were in print. So I found a couple copies from the end of the 19th century. I think of the lectures on heroes and hero worship, and maybe one other thing. So he was even more unknown in America at that time. Now, as Scott just said, Carlyle was one of the most influential writers in the Victorian era. But by the mid-20th century, he was, as we've said, almost forgotten. So how might we explain this to our audience?
One way of explaining it would be to say that he was as much stature as he had, he was very much of his time and place, which maybe he could, maybe his voice, his unique vo author's voice, as they like to say, could overcome that in his own lifetime and in living memory of the publication of his works. But in a certain sense, he doesn't speak beyond that time,
Right.
except, you know, except insofar as he does, because then there are other cases in which he seems to speak with more resonance now than he did then.
Right, yeah. And so the reasons for people sort of forgetting about him and not wanting to publish his books are fairly predictable, right? So the
Yes.
slavery question is a big one, right? He was on the, as we would say today, the wrong side of that, right? As many other interesting thinkers were from that time, and all, there are also these little details that apparently a copy of his 7-volume biography of the Prussian king Frederick the Great was found in Hitler's bunker, right? So Hitler and his men apparently found inspiration in that book in the bunker. And so his ideas are, in many ways, incompatible with the ideology of post-World War II liberalism, we can put it that way. And he has been accused as being a someone whose ideas prefigured fascism. So there's that you're going to find that out there. But now, almost again, as we've said, almost all of his works are being republished. I've got a stack of books next to me here, and there's interest in him online, and some very fairly famous online personalities have been singing his praises. I won't say who. We don't need to mention that all these online personalities. Suffice it to say, Carlyle is speaking to our times in ways that, as Scott just said, he probably couldn't to the post-World War II generation. So, in any case, he's someone that we ought to try to understand as well as we can. So I'd like to begin with one of the first things that Carlyle published, and this is his essay of, I believe, 1831. I might be wrong on the date there, but the title of the essay is Signs of the Times. And I should say about this that this essay, if anyone who has never read Carlyle before is looking for a good place to start, this is a piece that I would recommend. It's not an easy read. I have a colleague here at Campbell who apparently assigned this text to students, and she said that the students felt that reading Carlyle was something that was done to them, that they had been assaulted by this task of having to read Carlyle. So he's not easy to read, but at least this piece is short, and it contains the germs of many of the major ideas that he pursues in his career as a writer. So well, let's go to excerpt number one here from Signs of the Times. Scott, if you could.
Were we required to characterize this age of ours by any single epithet, we should be tempted to call it not an heroical, devotional, philosophical, or moral age, but above all others, the mechanical age. It is the age of machinery in every outward and inward sense of that word, the age which, with its whole undivided might, forwards, teaches, and practices the great art of adapting means to ends. Nothing is now done directly or by hand. All is by rule and calculated contrivance. For the simplest operation, some helps and accompaniments, some cunning abbreviating processes in readiness. Our old modes of exertion are all discredited and thrown aside. On every hand, the living artisan is driven from his workshop to make room for a speedier, inanimate one. The shuttle drops from the fingers of the weaver and falls into iron fingers that ply it faster. Excellence in what is called its higher departments depends less on natural genius than on acquired expertness in wielding its machinery.
Thank you. Right. So we have a theme that will be familiar right from the early 19th century. We were talking about the period of the Industrial Revolution where machines are replacing humans. And of course, this might make us think about the current time as well, where supposedly intelligent machines are replacing humans in a new way now. And the focus of those driving the change is entirely on what the machines can get done for us. So not so much on what the replacement of of human expertness with mechanical efficiency will do to us and as individuals and as a species. So again, this technology is great. It does stuff for us, but what's it going to do to us? That's the question that Carlyle is asking here. And there's a suggestion here that our humanity is being degraded, that rather than being liberated by the machines from undesirable labor, we are becoming extensions of the machines, right? What is a man? He is now, he used to be this this creature who had all sorts of amazing endowments, now a man is an operator of machines, and that's why we pay him, because he operates machines. And so and as all of this, and as the essay progresses, it becomes clear that our case is actually much worse than all of that. That not only are machines replacing humans, but humans are themselves are being affected by this replacement by machines. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Scott?
Well, I would say exposure to big tech is an eye-opener for anyone who thinks that the process is not still underway and with the same sort of speed and disruption that Carlyle saw in his own day. In certain senses, subsequent thinkers, even Marx had a lot of time for Carlyle. He doesn't really correct him in a lot of instances when he's talking about the human reality of industrialization. He's merely extending Carlyle's arguments. When he says that they tell you that there will be less work. But in fact, all it means there'll be more redundancies, and whoever's left is now an overseer of machines who works longer than any laborer would in a shift. Because they go, well, we can trust this person, so he'll watch the machines for, 18 hours, 20 hours, and then he'll come back tomorrow and do the same. And there is an effect on life that we still see, that's still unfolding, still reaching new corners, and crinkles in the human experience, which we see now with the chatbots, the stochastic panics we were talking about earlier. So we see much of the same. This is one of those instances where I would say the letter of what he's saying may apply less, but the spirit of what he's saying applies more now, with more relevance, as they like to say, more urgency than it did ever before.
Yes, I think that's very well said. Shall we go to excerpt number two?
These things, which we state lightly enough here, are yet of deep import and indicate a mighty change in our whole manner of existence. For the same habit regulates not our modes of action alone, but our modes of thought and feeling. Men are grown mechanical in head and in heart, as well as in hand. They've lost faith in individual endeavour and in natural force of any kind. Not for internal perfection, but for external combinations and arrangements, for institutions, constitutions, for mechanism of one sort or other, do they hope and struggle. Their whole efforts, attachments, opinions turn on mechanism and are of a mechanical character.
Thank you. Right. So, for Carlyle, it's we're not just talking about machines, whether they're the AI bots or the stochastic parrots or the spinning Jenny, but the effect is not that just that human beings are now being replaced by machines or having to operate machines, but this has affected the machines have affected our whole experience, all of life. Right. So. He says that me a mechanical way of thinking is now affecting the way we think about politics, the way we think about art, the way we think about religion, the way we approach morality, and of course there's a lot one could discuss there. But I thought we might go directly to what he says about constitutions, about the modern machinery of government, because that is the again for Carlyle also. A constitution, the modern constitution, is a kind of machine, a kind of mechanism. And when we think of government in that way, we're missing something in his view. So can you take it? Let's go to excerpt
Yeah,
number three,
sure.
which is fairly long. Yes.
In the very outset, we might note the mighty interest taking in mere political arrangements as itself the sign of a mechanical age. The whole discontent of Europe takes this direction. The deep, strong cry of all civilized nations, a cry which everyone now sees must and will be answered, is give us a reform of government. A good structure of legislation, a proper check upon the executive, a wise arrangement of the judiciary is all that is wanting for human happiness. The philosopher of this age is not a Socrates, a Plato, a Hooker, or Taylor, who inculcates on men the necessity and infinite worth of moral goodness, the great truth that our happiness depends on the mind which is within us. And not on the circumstances which are without us, but a Smith, a Delorme, a Bentham, who chiefly inculcates the reverse of this, that our happiness depends entirely on external circumstances, nay, that the strength and dignity of the mind within us is itself the creature and consequence of these. Were the laws, the government in good order, all were well within us. The rest would care for itself. Dissentients from this opinion, expressed or implied, are now rarely to be met with. Widely and angrily as men differ in its application, the principle is admitted by all. Equally mechanical and of equal simplicity are the methods proposed by both parties for completing or securing this all-sufficient perfection of arrangement. It is no longer the moral, religious, spiritual condition of the people that is our concern, but their physical, practical, economical condition is regulated by public laws. Thus is the body politic more than ever worshipped and tendered, but the soul politic less than ever. Love of country in any high or generous sense, in any other than an almost animal sense or mere habit, has little importance attached to it in such reforms or in the opposition shown them. Men are to be guided only by their self-interests. Good government is a good balancing of these, and except a keen eye and appetite for self-interest, requires no virtue in any quarter. To both parties, it is emphatically a machine. To the discontented, a taxing machine. To the contented, a machine for securing property. Its duties and its faults are not those of a father, but of an active parish constable.
Thank you. All right, so we might go back to the first paragraph there. So he met Carlyle mentions a series of thinkers here, and then he contrasts. Okay, there are the thinkers of the past: Socrates, Plato, Richard Hooker, the author of the Ecclesiastical Polity, the Government of the Ecclesiastical Polity, and then Taylor. I know less about him, but he was a writer of spiritual literature about how to I think the two major books he's known for are How to Live and How to Die. So How to Live and How to Die as a Christian. So these are works that are concerned with the soul. How do we make the human being the best sort of to give the human being the best sort of soul he can have to be a good Christian, a good man, a good father, a good ruler, if he should take on such responsibilities. So those are the philosophers of a prior age that cared about the quality of the human being himself and wanted to cultivate the best sort of human being. But now he says our thinkers are Adam Smith, right? So famous for his theory of the invisible hand, that when people pursue their economic interests, that it will all sort of work out for the best for everyone, and that everyone will be able to enjoy the lower prices and more consumer goods, right? And then Delorme is it was a Swiss writer who wrote a book praising the Constitution of England, because the Constitution of England was that perfect or almost perfect machinery of government that had checks and balances, that had a good check on the executive and prevented the kind of corruption and concentration of power that that modern politics is concerned about, right? And then, of course, people know who Bentham was, right? Bentham thought we could arrange incentives in such a way that people would pursue what was for the utility and avoid waste and so on. So we have the new age has new philosophers who are concerned about setting up the right machinery and not so much concerned with the quality of the human beings that are to inhabit that those institutions. So Carlyle is someone who has a great deal of doubt in the power of constitutional machinery for checking and balancing of self-interest. In this system, it seems to him, it's as if no virtue is needed. We don't need to have virtuous human beings in this system. He says elsewhere that the modern theory of constitutionalism is that greedy knaveries will check each other, as if one doesn't have to have one can extract order and productivity even from the worst sort of people. So you could compare Carlyle's skepticism about constitutions to Immanuel Kant's formulation in his essay on Perpetual Peace, where Kant says the problem of setting up a state can be solved even by a nation of devils, so long as they possess understanding, right? To set up the right incentives, and people will respond appropriately. That's the idea of government as a mechanism. Carlyle did not have faith in such systems. So there was no replacement for human goodness and for heroism, as we'll probably discuss later on. So anything you'd like to add, Scott, to those passages you just read?
I find it interesting that, given some of the other material that we're going to explore, this second paragraph especially, the ending of the paragraph, tells you something about his view of good governance, because here he explicitly, in I guess you can't even say that it's just an analogy. It's by analogy, but he seems to think of the virtues of rulership as another instantiation of the virtues of fatherhood. And that kind of gives you. Here we have a prefiguring of what we'll see with Dr. Francia. That's why he singles out this person, because his children, the inhabitants of Paraguay, one of the names they had for him was Father. He was there, and not as a, not as a preacher, he was a lawyer, but Father of the Nation. They would literally address him as father. That was one of their epithets for their leader, when they weren't calling him, El Supremo, or the various other names they had for him. And this is clearly, you get a flicker here of what he is for, rather than just what he is against.
Yes, right. That's right. And then, right. Of course, yeah. We'll talk about the text that Scott is referring to later on about the leader of Paraguay. But of course, it was traditional for Europeans to think of their kings as fathers of the nation as well. That was a traditional way of thinking. The term that scholars have for that is patriarchalism, right? That
Yes.
the father is the key authority figure, and the king is the father of the nation. And that there's obviously a much more personal relationship when you think about government in that way, that there's a more personal connection between the ruler and the ruled, and it's not the kind of relation, the sort of neutral or impartial relation that you would find in a machinery of government.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point to note, especially with view the machinery and the lack of virtue in a mechanical age. It's possibly worth noting that what Carlyle decries is the worst of both worlds with regard to the impersonal and personal elements. The government is an uncaring machine, but this within this machine, you have all kinds of knaves and double dealers who are extracting all kinds of advantage. And so you have the worst of the total impersonal indifference of a machine to a suffering populace on the one hand, and then all the worst elements of subjectivity and bias on the other, where people are in the politics for personal gain and convenience and comfort. Whereas what Carlyle proposes is the best of both worlds in a certain sense. If you look throughout his works, what he proposes is something that's not so much impersonal as impassive and implacable. A kind of discipline and a kind of personal and personal impersonalism, a kind of personal discipline which ignores pain and want so that the duty can be carried out effectively.
Yes, yeah, so
And the personal relations, like if you look at all of his examples, he's not entirely consistent in his choice of examples, but in what they exemplify is incredibly consistent. His modern examples and medieval examples are much the same. There's those personal relations that you talked about. Look at the Abbot Samson, right? This is the kind of person who has a personal care, but at the same time can do what needs to be done and isn't hamstrung, so to speak, by those feelings. Whereas, his contemporary English liberals, he would decry them for their spinelessness in some cases, brainlessness in others, and how they deal with people with this kind of mewling self-righteousness, but then cry for more of the machine that grinds the people into paste.
Yes, and so the Abbot Samson is an important figure in Carlyle's book Past and Present. But yeah, we'll see more examples, I think, of what Scott is talking about as we proceed. So let's see. Why don't we go to excerpt number four? So the machine, the machines, institutions, according to Carlyle, do not necessarily make noble human beings. Where then do these noble human beings come from? And then in excerpt four, we get some kind of answer to that question.
Yes, man is not the creature and product of mechanism, but in a far truer sense, its creator and producer. It is the noble people that makes the noble government, rather than conversely. On the whole, institutions are much, but they are not all. The freest and highest spirits of the world have often been found under strange outward circumstances. St. Paul and his brother apostles were politically slaves. Epictetus was personally one. Again, forget the influences of chivalry and religion and ask, What countries produced Columbus and Las Casas? Or descending from virtue and heroism to mere energy and spiritual talent, Cortes, Pizarro, Alba, Jimenez. The Spaniards of the 16th century were indisputably the noblest nation of Europe, yet they had the Inquisition and Philip II. They have the same government at this day and are the lowest nation. The Dutch too have retained their old constitution, but no siege of Leiden, no William the Silent, not even an Egmont or De Witt any longer appears among them.
Thank you. So yeah. So, if you would you mind going first? What do you make of this passage here?
Well, he's setting up a very clear reversal of what the causal argument is. You know, the causal argument all the way from the 18th century to his own day and afterward. He lived through possibly the most intense period of this view, because of course now they're heady with the, you know, their steam engines and whatever. They see it in the world around them, so their exuberance and their triumphalism is, you know, off the charts. They definitely think it's like a production, like, oh well, if we set up the factory correctly, we'll produce people and they will be of a sufficient quality. Whereas of course he takes the more, you know, the more human view that the man is the creator of the machine. And that applies also if your machine is government. And you may
Right.
have the machine left over at the end, you know, when you have your operators, but you do not have the kind of mind that built the machine.
Right. And so the appearance of the great man seems to be miraculous, or not, again, not necessarily consistent with the kinds of institutions that you would expect would make such a great man, right? So Saint Paul and his brother apostles, right? And Epictetus, people who were politically slaves but became some of the most noble that we can think of. I should mention in this context, since we are the Ciceronian society, Cicero has an interesting comment on this, and I don't, of course, I'm disorganized and I don't have the passage in front of me, but I'll summarize what Cicero says in On the Republic. He says essentially about the Roman constitution that great men set up good institutions, and then those good institutions help to inculcate good morals in future generations, but also that those institutions had to be maintained by good men. And so in Cicero's formulation, the institutions do not preserve themselves. The institutions by themselves do not create good men. And without good men, the institutions decay. And I think this would be consistent with what Carlyle's view, except that I'd say Carlyle is even more pessimistic about the power of institutions, that if the people are ignoble, good institutions will not save them, and great men will emerge or fail to emerge irrespective of the institutions. So the we are very much in Carlyle's view dependent on the appearance of these great and good men to salvage things. And I think, as we'll see also later on, in much of his, in many of Carlyle's later works, his emphasis is on how decayed the institutions are and how very much in need they are of a Herculean figure to, in effect, clean out the stables of corruption that the institutions have fallen into. All right, shall we go on to excerpt number 5.
Yeah, that's very germane to what we were just saying here. We figure society as a machine, and that mind is opposed to mind as body is to body, whereby two or at most 10 little minds must be stronger than one great mind. notable absurdity. For the plain truth, very plain, we think, is that minds are opposed to minds in quite a different way. And one man that has a higher wisdom, a hitherto unknown spiritual truth in him, is stronger not than 10 men that have it not, or than 10,000, but than all men that have it not, and stands among them with a quite ethereal angelic power, as with a sword out of heaven's own armoury, sky tempered, which no buckler and no tower of brass will finally withstand.
Right, thank you. So this is, we could say, an early assertion of Carlyle's great man theory of history. The great men, the God-inspired geniuses whose minds contain a great spiritual truth, they are the drivers of history. And so they are one man who has that is more powerful than not than 10, but then 10,000 or millions of men who do not have that spiritual truth and can be transformed by it, can become the a follower of the person who has brought that nobility, virtue, and enlightenment to other men. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that, Scott.
I know, I think it caps off the earlier remarks on the age of, the mechanical age in which we live. It's also interesting how it's a counterpoint to the overall tenor of pessimism that we just discussed, where he has a kind of radical optimism specifically about the inspired person, right? I mean, inspired in the sense of the divine inspiration, the divine breath, the higher spiritual truth that he talks about that dwells in them. And much more depends upon those inner spiritual qualities and personal qualities than in other thinkers or other systems, even other thinkers that would seem to be like Carlyle himself, who's very, this is one of these very good examples of how unique he is, or idiosyncratic, depending on the scholar describing him. But yeah, I noticed that really shines through. It's quite powerful. Quite a powerful passage,
Right.
especially against that extremely bleak background and the extremely bleak prospect that he may fail to appear. As you said, it's not guaranteed in Carlyle's long view of history.
Yes, right. I like the way you put that. That on the one hand, there is this extreme pessimism, but this also this great optimism that, or at least hope that the God-inspired man will appear in time to salvage things. All right, so in this volume, the volume that we're talking about, the best example of this kind of hero genius is probably John Knox, the leader of the Protestant Reformation in Scotland. In his essay on the Portraits of John Knox, which is one of the last things that Carlyle published in his life, Carlyle describes the interviews that Knox had with Mary, Queen of Scots. And this is our excerpt number 6.
He is never in the least ill-tempered with Her Majesty, but she cannot move him from that fixed centre of all his thoughts and actions. Do the will of God and tremble at nothing. Do against the will of God and know that in the immensity and the eternity around you, there is nothing but matter of terror. Nothing can move Knox here or elsewhere from that standing ground. No consideration of queens' sceptres and armies and authorities of men is of any efficacy or dignity whatever in comparison, and becomes not beautiful but horrible when it sets itself against the Most High.
Right, good. So that's right. So this, so again, Knox is the example of this, the divinely inspired man. In this case, the hero is Priest, right? Knox is also one of the heroes that figures in the lectures on heroes and hero worship. So this he has he knows what the truth is. He knows what God has commanded him to do, and he will stop at nothing. No scepter. No threat of physical death, no challenge will stop him from pursuing what he thinks is right. And now this also supplies us an occasion to discuss one of the tricky questions about Carlyle. What exactly were his religious beliefs? And I will admit that I have some uncertainty about this myself, but I'm going to point out an interpretation, a scholarly interpretation of what Carlyle's beliefs were. And this is from a book by, let's see, I have it here, by Charles Frederick Harold called Carlyle and German Thought. And what he says is that Carlyle was a Calvinist without the theology. So this might be one way we could characterize his thinking. I'm going to read the short description of that. He says, beneath the variations of the surface of his thinking, even throughout the years of his skepticism and despair, there persisted in him the essential spirit of Calvinism. The belief, at least, the will to believe in the infinite and transcendent sovereignty of God, to know and obey whom is man's supreme end, in the need of personal individual salvation through action rather than through passive states of soul, in the strenuous morality of knowing and doing the will of God, in the constant immanence of God in common things, revealing both love and law. So that's Harold's description of Carlyle's Calvinism without the theology, that there is a belief that the divine does operate through human beings in the world and that we have duties to God through that, but they're not necessarily, from that point of view, not an Orthodox Christian. So Carlyle did express skepticism about basic Christian beliefs privately. On the one hand, but in many of his writings, he defends Christian piety, and he makes the cause of Reformed Christianity his own cause. For instance, in the passage that Scott just read, so his praise of Knox could be taken as an expression of Reformed Christian piety, and then of course there's Oliver Cromwell, is another Puritan, whom Cromwell praised and wrote about. Of course, there's another possibility in Carlyle, and that would be that his religion is hero worship as such. So the great men of history, some of them priests, but many of them not, many of them kings or other political leaders, are the conduits through which we more ordinary human beings are able to see God's truth, to know God's laws. And of course, for a traditional Christian believer, that might raise alarm bells, right? So I, in the liturgy that I hear every Sunday, we hear the from the Psalms, right? Put not their faith in princes and sons of men, in whom there is no salvation. But Carlyle may be guilty of that. But again, his views on his actual beliefs are not entirely clear. I think there's some possibility of different interpretations. All right, why don't we could at least start Chartism, and then we'll see how far we get with that. So let's see. So the next essay we're going to talk about is one of his better known on Chartism. So the Chartists were working class people in England who started a movement to protest the treatment of workers in the factories, and they made a series of political demands, including universal manhood suffrage. And at this point in England, there were still property qualifications. This is around the year 1840 or so. And of his essays on social and political questions, this is one that a lot of Carlyle scholars like, for a couple of reasons at least. First, Carlyle is sympathetic to the workers and critical of England's ruling classes. And second, Carlyle explicitly attacks the laissez-faire approach to economic and social problems. One of the chapters is called simply Not Laissez-Faire, didn't love laissez-faire. He believed that government had a duty to act, to intervene in the market and address social problems head on. He characterizes the existing policy of the government as, quote, let all scramble and some be trodden down. The more familiar phrase was devil take the hindmost, right? And treating the poor as only a nuisance to be abated, which he says is an unconscionable dereliction of duty on the part of rulers. But when you consider his proposals for reform, well, center-left college professors would be less likely to support him there. So we've selected two quotations from Chartism. Scott, if you could read excerpt number 7.
Any law, however well meant as a law, which has become a bounty on unthrift, idleness, bastardy and beer drinking, must be put an end to. In all ways it needs, especially in these times, to be proclaimed aloud that for the idle man there is no place in this England of ours. He that will not work and save according to his means, let him go elsewhither. Let him know that for him the law has made no soft provision, but a hard and stern one. That by the law of nature, which the law of England would vainly contend against in the long run, he is doomed either to quit these habits or miserably be extruded from this earth, which is made on principles different from these. He that will not work according to his faculty, let him perish according to his necessity. There is no law juster than that.
Thank you. All right, so let me give a little context for that quotation. So in this instance, Carlyle is discussing provisions of England's existing poor law and explaining that the poor law is half right, right? It is right in that those who are idle are sent to workhouses as a punishment to discourage idleness. So Carlyle approves of that part of it. He assumes here and elsewhere that there is always a subset of the underclass who will not work and who will not accept discipline unless they are compelled. And so the government must be willing to be harsh with freeloaders. And I would also remark that, you know, Carlyle's language often, even if it doesn't directly quote scripture, he's often paraphrasing scripture. So I'm thinking of 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10, which says, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if anyone would not work, neither should he eat. So in the New Testament, you have this similar command about discipline, the necessity of work for all members of the community. But as he says, hardness toward freeloaders is only part of a solution. Most of the underclass are capable of and deserving of a lot more, but they don't know what's best for them. So although they may be demanding the right to vote, Carlyle believed they actually wanted something else. And this is what he believes they mean. And now Scott will read excerpt number 8.
Guide me, govern me. I am mad and miserable and cannot guide myself. Surely of all rights of man, this right of the ignorant man to be guided by the wiser, to be, gently or forcibly, held in the true course by him, is the indisputablest. Nature herself ordains it from the first. Society struggles toward perfection by forcing and accomplishing it more and more. If freedom have any meaning, it means enjoyment of this right, wherein all other rights are enjoyed. It is a sacred right and duty on both sides, and the summary of all social duties whatsoever between the two. Why does the one toil with his hands, if the other be not to toil still more unweariedly with heart and head?
Thank you. So what Carlyle rejects is the modern relationship between social classes in a capitalist economy in which, this is another quotation, in which cash is the sole nexus between man and man. That's a fairly famous line from, I think, Carlyle's Past and Present. So in this modern relationship where the factory hands receive their wages and are otherwise left to shift for themselves. So what Carlyle wanted was something like the old feudal bond between lord and serf, but modified somehow for modern conditions. So human relations, as you can tell from that quotation, are hierarchical by nature. That is Carlyle's belief. The wiser must govern the less wise. So the upper classes owe the lower classes a lot more than wages. And in this essay on Chartism, he has two specific proposals at the end. First, education must be made available to the underclass, not only vocational training for factory or field hands who show potential to rise to some kind of mastership, but education in religion, in letters, in culture. In other words, an education to shape their character, to civilize them. So that's the first thing he proposes. And second, he says that that England needs new Hengists, referring to the Anglo-Saxon king who led the conquest of Britain in the 6th century. New Hengists, new conquerors needed to lead poor but capable Englishmen abroad to conquer and settle new territories. And if we consider what the British Empire did in the course of the 19th century with its so-called surplus population, it employed both of these strategies, I think, with considerable success. So everyone obviously knows about England's colonization projects. What is perhaps less known is the degree to which the British government and also British private associations, okay, Carlyle would have been less enthusiastic about the private associations, but they did this too. They took the underclass in hand and civilized them. For those interested in this, this Victorian social policy is discussed in a few books by Gertrude Himmelfarb, by which the Victorian elites civilized the working class and brought them into society in that way. Is there anything you'd like to add to this quotation you just read, Scott?
I think if you look at the state of what was known of culture, letters, and religion by that underclass, you would understand what an achievement that was. I recently watched a set of excerpts from interviews that various researchers had done at the time, where they would, I think it was also taken from journalists and whatnot, where they would interview the poor of London, the illiterate poor, and some of the ideas they had about Christian orthodoxy, how many gods there are and things like this, and how many years there had been since man debouched out of Eden. Are quite eyebrow raising, and so you understand those efforts achieved quite a bit with the with the population they had, with which they were working. It's quite an achievement,
That's a great point. And at the risk of causing trouble for myself, I might wonder aloud about the level of education of the populations we have today, and the extent to which how much do they know about cultural and civilization? How much do they know about religion? There's perhaps they need guidance. Perhaps the current generation also needs guidance.
I suppose the modern day, our contemporary equivalent would be even when I was younger, I remember watching a news report where they interviewed people at Christmas time asking them what Christmas was and why we have it, and it was the same sort of thing. So I suppose these public-spirited individuals who are like the mini heroes in Carlyle's view, I suppose we are lacking those. So it doesn't matter if we have any number of institutions, the World Health Organization and USAID and whatever, all these ones that cater to the betterment of the sick and the poor, supposedly, we are lacking the individuals who would actually have that effect. That's
Sadly,
what I've
that
seen.
seems to be the case, yes. All right, so I think we've been going for about an hour. I think we might take a break here and continue in part two of this episode.
All right, yeah.
You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. Be sure to rate and review this podcast. Share it with your friends. Please also check out our journal, Pietas. Pietas is a peer-reviewed, open-access journal. To submit your own work to the editors of Pietas, please go to our website, ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Scott, today for all of your reading and for your commentary.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.